Good morning, everybody.
Sorry, I said good morning, Margaret. I just realized I was muted.
Good morning. Hi, Dr. Mastoros, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good morning, all.
Good morning, everyone. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can see everybody. We haven't started yet, right?
Correct.
Okay. I do have a question. Where exactly to find different disciplinary actions that we can take?
That's
rules.
Yeah, it is, but that's board business. So can we talk about that as a group? Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. It's the statutes and rules, but we can't talk about board business, and that would be part of board business. So,
can I just say page 15 is a good page to look at?
Okay. We'll say it again.
Okay.
Ah, here we go.
Just letting the complainants who are present in the waiting room know that they should change it to their initials.
We have new people today, or a new person.
Yes. Oh. Good morning, Ms. Galan.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Margaret.
We'll do introductions
when the meeting starts, but. Okay, I'm going to admit the waiting room, Madam President, so you can start in a couple minutes.
Margaret, is this everyone you believe, or are we waiting for anybody else?
Let's see. Oh, there's Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Cohen, yeah.
Yeah, he's just put up.
Okay.
yes, I think everybody is here, so.
Okay. Good morning, anybody. I'd like to call this Arizona State Board of Optometry meeting today, February 4th, 2020, to order at 9 a.m. Ms. Chavez, would you like to call roll?
Thank you, Madam President. Dr. Restores?
Present.
Dr. Cohen?
Present.
Dr. Carpenter? Dr. Carpenter? Noted absent. Public member Diva Galan.
Here.
Dr. Moffitt.
Present.
Let the record show that there's one public member is still vacant. Madam President, we have a quorum. Staff, Ms. Whalen.
Present.
Veronica Chavez is present. Legal counsel Mona Baskin.
Present. And I did want to let everybody know that I'm going to be toggling between the Zoom screen and then I have another screen open with the board materials. So if I go offline, that's why you're not seeing me, just so that I can access the materials during the board's discussion. So good morning, all. And good morning, Ms. Galan, and welcome.
Good morning.
All right, thank you. I'm going to read the board meeting statement of purpose. A license to practice optometry in this state is a privilege granted by the Arizona legislature through the Optometric Practice Act. In 1907, on behalf of the people of the state, the legislature created the Arizona State Board of Optometry to regulate the practice of the profession of optometry, issue licensure where appropriate, and in general, assure the public that the practices of optometry will be conducted with reasonable skill and safety by persons who meet the curriculum requirements to hold the Doctor of Optometry degree from an accredited optometry school. To enforce the Optometric Practice Act, the board reviews applications for licensure and complaints relative to the conduct of its licensed optometrists and is charged with determining if the provisions of the Optometric Practice Act are met. In addition, the board may promulgate rules and policies in conformity with the stated purpose of the board and the mission as mandated by law. As of January 1, 2019, all board meetings are digitally recorded with the recordings of the audio available to the public on the board's website under the consumer information link. Agenda item C, President's Report. I'd like to take a minute and welcome our new public board member, Ms. Diva Galan. Hopefully I'm saying your name correctly. Okay. And you're muted. I was going to give you an opportunity if you'd like to introduce yourself. Tell us about yourself if you'd like.
Sure. My name is Diva Galan. I'm a public member of this board. I was appointed to this board after doing some work with the naturopathic board. So I'm on that board right now as well. And I come from an administrative law background. I worked for the nursing board for a few years, and then I worked for a group of judges for the federal government doing also administrative law. So I have a good background in the administrative part, and I'm excited to learn more about the optometry part. So.
Wonderful. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Right. Madam President, as you begin your agenda, would you be interested in taking item E1, Dr. Jeffrey Natchez, first, and then item D4, Dr. Gregory Simpson.
Sure. So item agenda E, review, discussion, and possible action on pending renewal applications. Dr. Jeffrey Natchez. So I understand Dr. Natchez was denied his license application for administrative reasons in Kansas and is currently awaiting a hearing. We have his license in front of us as a renewal. Is there any discussion amongst the board concern about re-licensure for Dr. Natchez? Dr. Cohen, any concerns on your part? Oh, you're muted. Sorry, we can't hear you.
I'm sorry, just looking for the additional information about it. But no, I don't have anything to express about it right now.
Okay. Dr. Mestores?
Same, I don't have any concerns. Okay.
Ms. Galan, any concerns on your part?
Not at this time.
Okay. I also have no concerns. Margaret, I don't believe we need any motion or anything further, correct?
Because it's agendized, if you would just direct staff to go ahead and renew the application.
Okay. So the board has no concerns about renewal of Dr. Natchez's application.
Thank you so much. Dr. Natchez is present if you wanted to ask him anything.
Dr. Moffitt, members of the board, this is Mona Baskin. Pardon me for jumping in. But because it is on the agenda for the board's consideration, it would be probably best practice for the board to motion to approve the application and a second and then a vote.
Okay.
I move that we approve Dr. Natchez's renewal.
Dr. Mestores, I second.
Any further discussion? Okay, so we'll vote. Ms. Galan?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. So motion passes 4-0. We'll move on to agenda item D, review, discussion, and possible action on investigative reviews and complaints. We'll start with number four, Gregory Simpson. Dr. Simpson, I believe you're present on the call. I see your name there. And then is patient SM present with regard to complaint 202214? Do we have any conflicts of interest among the board members with regard to this complaint? Okay, I hear none. Let's see here. As this is a virtual and telephonic meeting, I'd like all in attendance to preface their comments with their name so all participants know who is speaking. If you are a patient, please refer to yourself with your initials only for privacy purposes. Okay. And then with regard to Dr. Simpson, IR number 202214, can I get a board summary, please? Someone on the board like to summarize this case?
I can summarize.
Thank you, Dr. Mastor.
Dr. Mastor is here. This is IR 202214, patient SM and Dr. Simpson. The date of examination was July 1st, 2021, I believe. And the patient's complaining that they were not diagnosed with macular degeneration until it was too late. So the patient describes that she had a regular eye exam with a Dr. Glessman, a routine eye exam in July. He gave her a new glasses prescription and told her that she had the start of AMD or macular degeneration. In October, she began to have blurry vision in her right eye. And I believe she tried to make another appointment. I think at that office, I'm not 100% sure. She eventually was seen on November 23rd by Dr. Simpson. He did find that she had worsening macular degeneration in that eye and wanted her to get a test with a retina specialist. There was some sort of scheduling issue, and the patient did not go that route with his office, but then went to another office and was then went to a retina specialist and had treatment. I was a little confused by the timing and who, where, when, what, why. That is, the patient felt that she was not seen at an appropriate time frame. I believe that's the complaint. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Mistores. And then just to confirm, patient SM is not on the phone and is not present, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Dr. Simpson, would you like to take an opportunity to share your thoughts on this complaint? You'll need to unmute.
Okay, I'm unmuted now. Okay. Can you hear me?
I hear you. Yep,
yes. We hear
you. It's just basically just a summary of what's in that letter I sent. I saw this patient came in with a complaint of reduced acuity in the right eye, and so we did a dilated exam and an OCT scan, and it looked, just had a lot of atrophy and drusen too, and it looked like it probably was converting over to wet macular degeneration. And so we told her that what was going on, and we needed to probably have her come back for a fluorescein angiogram and to follow up with one of our ophthalmologists. And that was pretty much it. I guess they were pretty booked up, and so they couldn't get her on an official schedule until sometime in the middle of January. But I think she was also told that they would probably have a cancellation and be able to get her in sooner. And then she canceled her appointment on the 1st of December after the holiday. And then and I guess she went and saw another optometrist there in Kingman. And then he referred her to the retinal specialist, Dr. Paula Jawala, and who started treatments on her, I'm guessing Avastin treatments on the 17th. I guess that's all I know.
Okay. Does this conclude your comments, Dr. Simpson?
Yeah, you have all the records and stuff there. So.
We do. Thank you. So this will conclude open discussion, and I'll open this up for board members to discuss. Any comments from the board? I have a few comments I'll start with. So in reviewing this complaint, I felt like it was diagnosed appropriately. And so that's, I agree with Dr. Simpson on that front. What stood out to me and what bothered me in this complaint is that patient SM called with an initial complaint of a new onset spot in the vision and had to wait 2 weeks. That's a long time for a triage appointment with sudden onset dark spot in the vision. And then when she was seen by Dr. Simpson, the follow-up, so I agreed with your diagnosis, I agree with your assessment, I looked at the OCT, I agree with all of that, but a two-month wait at that point, which is what she was quoted, if this was on November 23rd, she was told it would be January 23rd or 24th, I think, and it would be 2 months before she could be seen. We all know that if this is early exudative AMD, if the lesion bleeds or hemorrhages at this point, it will scar and she will have lost vision. And so this is a grossly inappropriate wait time as far as I'm concerned. If I see a patient with a new onset exudative lesion like that, I usually call retina and have them seen the same day or the next day. That's how it's done in my office, same day or next day referral. So a 2 month wait, patient would have had vision loss if she was forced to wait that long. So I completely agree with her complaint in this instance. And Dr. Simpson, if your staff is not following up with appropriate timelines, you need to be made aware of when, if you have a referral, when they're going to be seen so that you can alter that or change it. If I have a follow-up that is not to my liking, I either have one of my technicians call the office again and say what I want, or I get on the phone myself and call the doctor. So as far as I'm concerned, I think the appropriate course of action here would be a letter of concern regarding the timeliness, right? So patient initially was not seen for 2 weeks with a new onset triage complaint, and then was given a referral date of 2 months for an emergent problem. This is inappropriate as far as I'm concerned and could have resulted in vision loss on the part of the patient. Those are my thoughts. Anyone else on the board want to discuss this?
I agree with you.
Thank you, Dr. Mastoris. Dr. Cohen, any thoughts on this?
If I might ask, is it possible to ask whether Dr. Simpson was aware of the fact that there was a 2-month delay in getting that appointment?
I was not aware of that at all. Nobody brought it to my attention. I probably would have said something if that was brought to my attention. And I totally agree with you. Usually we get them back within a week. I don't know why they couldn't get her in sooner. In fact, usually what they'll do is they'll even do an Avastin injection on them and then have them back for the floor seat angiogram. So mm-hmm. I don't know where the wires got crossed.
So I would look at it, and I agree with the comments that were made that it sounds like Dr. Simpson did everything correct, but there's poor follow-up or communication from the office, and maybe perhaps some better training about that or better communication of what's urgent versus something that could wait until the next available appointment.
We've had a lot of staffing issues. We've lost a lot of staff recently, and so.
You mean like the rest of the world?
Yes. Don't exactly know the reason for that, but we've lost a lot of staff. Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot of new employees, and we've been trying to manage that situation.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Simpson. Dr. Cohen, any further comments?
Yeah, a question for you, Dr. Moffitt, if I might. If we do a letter of concern, can it be specified that there was not an issue with Dr. Simpson's level of care or his diagnosis, but in the follow-up by either himself and his office in getting a prompt referral?
Absolutely. Go ahead, Margaret. You're on mute. Margaret, you're on mute. We can't hear you.
Sorry, I forgot I muted myself. Thank you, Madam President, Dr. Cohen. The letter of concern would actually address the staff issue itself. So it's sort of like the omission of not, you know, it's implied that there's no patient care issues based on how the letter of concern would be written.
And this is Mona Baskin, Assistant Attorney General. Yes, and I think that would comport with your statute, the ARS 32-1744-F, regarding the definition of a letter of concern, that the board has a reasonable basis to believe that a violation of the chapter of rules has occurred, but it's not sufficient seriousness to warrant disciplinary action. So the identification of what the concern is of the board is appropriate for the letter of concern, and the board's audio, and in the event that written minutes are created from this meeting, the board's discussion would be documented in those minutes regarding what issues you felt were appropriate.
Okay, thank you. So I'd like to make a motion that we send a letter of concern to Dr. Gregory Simpson regarding the inappropriate timeline of his triage appointment scheduling, and that it needs to be more timely, and followed up on his part.
Dr. Master, I saw a second.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so we'll vote. Ms. Glom, how do you vote?
Aye. I agree.
Okay. Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastoris?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. This concludes Dr. Simpson's complaint. So we'll move on now to...
Madam President?
Yes.
Excuse me, patient CM is online for Dr.
I
Colson.
See. Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
I see you. So we'll move on to agenda item D2, Dr. David Colson, IR number 202212. Patient GM, I see that you are present on the meeting. Is Dr. Colson present? Has he called in? No? Okay. And so I'll repeat this. Are there any conflicts with any of our board members with regard to this complaint? And I'll just say this in general for all of our complaints this morning. Are there any conflicts I need to be made aware of? Okay. So we'll move forward with Dr. David Colson's complaint, IR number 202212. Can I have a board summary for Dr. Colson? Dr. Cohen, would you be able to do that?
Yes, Dr. Moffitt, I was trying to access my notes. I'm having trouble getting it, but if I can give a general overview from what I recalled is that the patient stated that set up a routine eye exam, and upon going for the eye exam, there was a diagnosis of asteroid hyalosis and early nuclear sclerotic cataracts. And as a result, it was changed from going from the patient's avesis vision care plan to the medical plan, and appears to have then caused an increase in the out-of-pocket cost to the patient. The patient felt that it was inappropriate to have been switched because they were there for a routine eye exam. And supposedly Dr. Colson and Barnett Delaney have since offered to reverse those and to not charge either insurance plan, the medical or the vision plan, in light of the miscommunication that occurred to the patient.
Okay, thank you. So patient GM, I'll remind you to refer yourself only as GM. And would you like to take a moment to describe your concerns in this complaint?
Good morning, and appreciate the opportunity to speak. I was scheduled for a routine eye exam. I wasn't told anything about a follow-up or the need to see a specialist. I really found it very interesting when I first made contact to Barnett Delaney that the call center immediately asked the question, you know, did the doctor talk to you about cataracts? Because if he did, then it is a medical procedure and not an eye exam. And so I just felt like that was inappropriate. I go for an eye exam every single year. I am 60 years old this year. And I do recognize that at some point in my future, I will have to probably have cataract surgery, but not at this point in time. On the following Monday, I made a routine eye exam with the same doctor for my daughter. And because she's only 38, 39, her vision claim was processed accordingly, and there was no issue. So I just felt like that even though I tried to talk to the billing specialist, I tried to reach out by phone several times, I tried to reach out by letter, it fell on deaf ears. So I appreciate, I appreciate them retracting the decision to bill me. But I think that the biggest concern here is the practice of the call center saying, you know, it was changed from a routine eye exam to some other diagnosis. And in my opinion, I think that the routine eye exam should have occurred. And then if there was a further diagnosis, then I should have been rescheduled for another appointment. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. So I'll open this up now for board discussion amongst the members. Would anyone like to address this complaint? Their thoughts?
Yes, Dr. Moffitt, for this, Dr. Cohen. I had a question of the patient. Looking at the chart, it didn't specify routine eye exam. It specified dry eyes as the purpose for the visit. And I was just curious as to how that was discussed, either when the appointment was made, where clearly the patient is stating his impression was it was just a routine eye exam, but it's listed as a dry eye as the cause for the visit.
That is completely inaccurate. It was a routine eye exam. I presented my avesis card at the time of registration. They accepted my $10 copay, and I I had never brought up any issues when I made the appointment. It was just a routine eye exam for a prescription for new glasses.
So last thing, so then you're saying there was no discussion then about dry eyes being the purpose of the visit?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you very much.
Dr. Mestores, any comments?
Yes, great question, Dr. Cohen. I also was wondering about that. And with the response from the patient, I do feel like it should have just been a routine eye exam. So whether Dr. Coulson did a medical eye exam, it has to go back to the chief complaint, and the patient repeatedly asked for a routine eye exam. So I think that is an issue. And this comes up a lot. It can, you know, we in a routine eye exam, we do everything. And so it's tough to distinguish between what to say, what not to say, what's covered, what's not. But I do think the appropriate action would have been to bring the patient back for medical following that. So I have some concerns.
Okay. Ms. Galan, any comments?
Not at this time, just listening.
Okay. So I'll offer my opinion, and I'm going to say some of this for the benefit of the patient, just so that you know what our training is and what we're supposed to do under these circumstances. So it's a routine eye exam is the same whether we bill your avesis or whether we bill your medical. It's really based on the diagnosis. And we are trained when there is a medical diagnosis to bill the appropriate party, which is the medical insurance, compared to when there is a vision complaint, then that would be something that goes towards your vision insurance. And so I will say that in this exam, the chief complaint was, it was a dry eye complaint, just as Dr. Cohen stated, but they may have asked you when they checked you in, not at the front desk, but when you were speaking with a technician, how are you doing? How are your eyes? And if you commented anything like, well, they've been a little dry lately, that is a medical complaint and that goes towards medical insurance. And I don't know if that conversation took place or did not. I'm just telling you, when we look at the record and then we see that, that immediately differentiates it as a medical complaint versus when you come in and you say, my near vision is blurry with my glasses and I need them updated. That's a vision complaint. So those two complaints differentiate the sort of intent of the exam, even though the exam is the same. For instance, also, if during an exam, the doctor was to have discovered a mole on your eyelid that looked suspicious, or a cataract, or heavy lids, or dry eye findings on the surface of the eye. Those are medical findings. And when you have medical findings, you are supposed to bill it towards the medical provider, right? So if you submit medical findings towards the vision provider, they can deny it. And it is supposed to go to the medical provider. Comparatively, if you were to submit a vision exam, so where you have nothing but a refractive code, so you have someone maybe like your daughter who has myopia or hyperopia or astigmatism, only has a vision complaint and only has a vision finding, then that goes to the vision provider. And this is a common area of misunderstanding between doctors and patients. I think Dr. Coulson should have discussed it with you, but I would warn you. So just in your exam, right? So there was a dry eye chief complaint, and then there were three medical findings listed. It was mild cataract formation, it was heavy lids or dermatoschelasis, and then also vitreous opacities. Those are all medical findings during the exam. And this happens actually as our age increases. I mean, once you get to be 55, it's almost hard not to look in the eye and see something of a medical nature as opposed to a vision. So it's a conversation that should have taken place between Dr. Coulson and yourself. I think communication is to blame, but I don't, just so for your information, I don't have any concerns about fraud or manipulation of the record. It doesn't strike me that way. So those are my thoughts on it. If you have any questions for me or you want to take a moment and talk to me about this, I'd invite you to do so if you want to come off mute.
Yeah, there were no discussions between me and anyone in the practice in regards to any complaints whatsoever. I've been seeing optometrists for all of my life. I've been wearing glasses since I was 6 years old. So the only reason that I went to that provider is because they were a provider that was on a visas. The year before, I went to another provider, Dr. Heller, and didn't have an issue with my insurance being billed. But I just felt like Barnett Delaney, I just don't feel like that they handled my case appropriately, and they refused to talk to me.
Yes, I understand that. I agree with you that a lot of this stuff comes down to poor communication. But I just want you to know, I don't see this as suspicious behavior or potentially fraudulent behavior. So this is a common area of miscommunication among patients and doctors. Sometimes we don't even know what insurance plan you're there under. I have to make a concerted effort to look at the patient's insurance constantly to see if I need to address this in any way, right? So we just kind of sit down and do our job and fill out the bill appropriately, right? This is what I did. This is the assessment. This is my plan. Sign the chart. Frequently, I have to remind myself to look at the insurance to make sure I communicate to the patient if there's something that I think a problem they're going to run into. It usually comes better if I bring it up as opposed to someone in the billing office, right? If I foresee a problem, it's better coming from me if I say, listen, I know you came in today with this, but actually you have this and we need to follow it. This takes priority and precedence. This is the concern. So sometimes it can get slipped, and he should have discussed it with you and they should have handled it better. They did no charge the complaint, but I don't believe that there is a major concern of fraud or anything like that. So that's what my comments were meant to reassure. I'm going to open this back up to the board. Do we have any other discussion among the board members? Any other comments? Does anyone want to make a motion?
I would like to make a motion to issue a letter of concern to the doctor, because I feel that the practice itself needs to look better at the way that they handle these cases, because it's probably a common thing that's going to happen. So I want to issue a letter of concern. What else? Not sure how to word it.
For billing, Dr. Mastoris?
Yes, yes. Routine versus medical billing. And hi, Mona.
Hi. I guess it's so hard on Zoom, and I just don't want to be impolite and jump in, but maybe this would be helpful also. It would be communication with the patient regarding billing when medical diagnosis, diagnosee are discovered during the exam or are the chief complaint. Would that capture it, doctors?
Yes.
And
yes.
Ms. Galan? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll raise my hand from now on. Thank you.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. So I'll open this up to vote. Dr. Mastoris has made a motion to send a letter of concern to Dr. Colson regarding communication regarding billing for the patient or for his patients. I knew I was going to say that to you, Ms. Galan. I'm going to do that a few times. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Okay. Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastoris?
Aye.
I vote nay. Motion passes 3-1. I see we have another member to the meeting, but I'm not sure if this is a complainant of the case we're about to review.
Madam President, actually that was the complainant for Dr. Simpson's.
Oh, I see.
Complaint. So I've already let her know that we did hear the complaint already and what the result was.
Okay. All right. So then we'll move on to agenda item D1. Leonard Muscolino, IR number 202211. I think I'll offer a board summary in this case. Patient MH saw Dr. Muscolino for routine eye exam where the patient was having tearing and tired eye complaints. A new glasses prescription was issued with an increase in hyperopic correction. Patient MH picked up the glasses and felt that they had a glare, brightness, and reflection issues. When he returned to the optical, he was told there would be an additional charge. They would remake the glasses, but there would be a charge to add the additional feature to the glasses. And he felt like this was unfair. Patient declined to recheck with the doctor, and on the initial prescription, which isn't required but was present, an anti-reflective coating was suggested. Okay. And then just to be certain, patient MH is not available and on the phone or on the call. And Dr. Muscolino is not present, correct? Okay. So then I'll open this up for board discussion. Any comments among the board members? I'll start. I didn't think actually there was any concern here, actually. So the patient did have a tired eye complaint. He did get a prescription where he had increased hyperopic correction. It matched his complaint. It looked like that would solve the problem. When he goes and purchases glasses, he decides what features and add-ons he's going to put on there and what he wants to pay for. He declined an anti-reflective coating and then had reflective complaints after he got the glasses. When he went back, he was offered that they would remake them with the anti-reflective coating, but there's an upcharge for that. My analogy to this is ordering the pizza without the toppings you want and then going back and asking for the pizza items, but without wanting to pay for them. So this is standard practice that he would have to pay the difference on the feature that he wanted, and he elected not to pursue it. So I saw no violation here. Any other comments?
Dr. Mestaris, I agree, and I move to dismiss the complaint. Thank you.
I second that, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you. So we have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? So we'll vote. We have a motion to dismiss the complaint against Dr. Muscolino. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye. Motion to dismiss.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestaris?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. I see patient PC has joined us, and so I'll call a complaint against Dr. Kelsey Stevens. IR number 202213. Can I get a board summary in this case? I can offer it. Patient PC saw Dr. Stevens, and patient PC, just since you're hearing this, you need to refer to yourself as PC during our discussion. Patient PC saw Dr. Stevens for new onset bilateral spot in the center of the vision times 1 week. That was the chief complaint listed in her record. During the patient history, the patient admitted to a history of drug use. Patient was diagnosed with talc retinopathy on exam, and a retinal referral was discussed but ultimately decided against. There was a screening visual field that was done bilaterally, and a optic nerve OCT was performed. Given this was a bilateral spot in the vision, though, there was no MRI ordered, and there was no retina consult or angiogram referral, nor was there a neuro-ophthalmology referral. In the Dr. Stevens' response to the board, she suggested this was a longstanding vision loss, but the chief complaint clearly states the loss was for 1 week. In addition, the notes from Dr. Christopher Reedus's office has also suggested a more short timeline for the vision loss. Okay. And so at this time, if patient PC would like to offer any comments or thoughts about the complaint that he brought forward, this is your opportunity to address the board. And you're muted, so you'll need to unmute.
All right. Well, what happened was, is I went in there and she pretty much told me it was really urgent that I go see an MD because she wasn't an MD. And it was really urgent. She didn't know what it was. And then she asked me about the drug issue. I brought it up. I was honest with her, which everyone told me was a mistake. I shouldn't have been, but I was anyways. And then she immediately just blamed that. She just said that was the cause. She immediately knew what it was and that was the cause. And then she told me she was still going to refer me. So I left. Then I came. Then I called back 2 days later because the place she said was being referred to never called me like they were supposed to. And then they told me they canceled it, the referral, after I had left. And then, well, she didn't tell me what to do after that. Like, she just told me I had a long-standing issue; it would be permanent. It might, even in her own assessment, which you have a copy of, she said it wasn't just to correct the vision; it was just to stop progression. Well, it turned out to be an infection. It was neurosyphilis. So the complaint I have with her is because she didn't really follow up like she was supposed to, like referring to me to an actual doctor, MD. So it got worse. It probably got way worse, actually. So she kind of just left me hanging. And it was kind of annoying. Kind of wish she would have done that. So I had to go wait a month to actually go see an MD. I had to get on access and then get a referral, and then go to Dr. Christoph's. And we did some blood work. It took 3 weeks to get the blood work back. And then eventually it came back as positive for syphilis. They didn't do a lumbar test or anything like that. They just gave me the regimen of penicillin LA once a week, little two shots once a week for 3 weeks. The second shot, about 2 days after I got the second shot, it immediately disappeared just as fast as it came on. So I'm just kind of annoyed that she never referred me like she was supposed to, because it would have been found probably a lot sooner. I wouldn't have been out of work for 3.5 months behind on everything. And then she pretty much lied to me about referring me and then canceling it. And then she took, well, it's also the reason why she said she canceled. She said, she thought I couldn't afford it. I had no problem paying for anything. Actually, I already had it set up and everything. And yeah, that's pretty much what happened. It's kind of annoying because she didn't refer me, so I just left. She left me hanging. I didn't know what to do after that. Am I supposed to live in a box or something? I don't know. Lose my job, lose everything. So I just left me hanging. It's kind of an annoying process.
Okay.
Wish she wouldn't have done that.
Does this conclude your comments towards the board?
Yeah.
Okay. And then I'll just ask... I don't see Dr. Stevens present, but I just want to make sure she hasn't called in. Dr. Stevens is not present in the conversation. Okay. So then I'll open this up for conversation amongst the board members. Would anyone like to start?
I think that this is Dr. Messors. I think that there was a failure to refer, which is I think Article 4, Referral 32-1761. I think she would be in a violation of that. And thankfully, the patient did get care, but it was too long, in my opinion.
I'll jump in here with my thoughts. I was surprised at how this was handled. I thought it was handled poorly. When you have a bilateral complaint, there's a suggestion of a neuro component. The doctor in this case seemed to jump to the conclusion, and this is an assumption on my part, but once she heard the history, it seemed like she almost jumped to the diagnosis, and then the findings on the exam, I don't know that they really support the diagnosis. So first of all, arriving at the assessment that this was a talc retinopathy, when you look at the OCT, you don't necessarily see talc on it. And that could happen, right? The OCT is focused on a narrow area of the retina. It's possible you would not see talc on it. And so that's fine. The visual field was a screening visual field. It wasn't even a threshold visual field. And like I mentioned, there was no fluorescein suggested. There was no MRI suggested. All of this is an inappropriate workup. She jumped to a conclusion without proper subsequent testing to support the diagnosis. In Dr. Christopher Reedus's notes, there's no talc retinopathy mentioned. And so I would have to say there was no talc retinopathy present when the patient saw Dr. Stevens. So I would view this differently if they're not completely differently, but I would view this a little differently than how I view it now. If there was a talc retinopathy present and neurosyphilis, right? So that one somewhat concealed the other in the eyes of the doctor, but that's not even what looks like happened here. So it was a misdiagnosis as far as I'm concerned. The patient should have been referred for a fluorescein and for MRI. Much more testing was needed. Either she needed to order the testing herself or she needed to refer to a specialist to do it. And ultimately, this could have resulted in vision loss on his part. And neurosyphilis can also be fatal. And so this could have also been a loss of life. So this is a very, very, very big misstep. I believe that the board needs to send a message to Dr. Stevens to practice in a way that is much more consistent with her training. So I agree with you, Dr. Mastores. I think that there is room here for concern. I also, when I am looking at the statutes, I believe that the complaint here in the conduct of the doctor is consistent with potential incompetency and unprofessional conduct that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of patients and the public. My suggestion, and I would open this up to the board for further discussion, of course, but my suggestion is that we try to obtain a consent agreement from Dr. Stevens that has some disciplinary action involved. I think that a license suspension of 30 days and probation going forward is appropriate. This is what I propose. Dr. Cohen, do you have any thoughts on this?
I'm a bit mixed on it because it seems if the breakdown occurred in, as a matter of fact, in the notes, I think it says that could refer to a retinal specialist. And I wouldn't have hesitated to make that referral immediately upon those findings, if nothing else than to confirm what my suspicion was. So I believe that there should certainly be disciplinary action. I'm not sure, you eloquently stated about what the ramifications could have been, vision loss and potentially loss of life because of the nature of the neurosyphilis, but not sure about in terms of 30-day suspension. I'd like that discussed a little bit more.
What do you propose, Dr. Vaughn?
I would look at and think perhaps probation as well as perhaps some continuing education requirement in the specified area could be a reasonable alternative.
Okay. Ms. Galan, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I'm not sure. I guess question would be if the executive director has spoken with the physician in the sense, would there be willingness to sign a consent agreement or, you know, that kind of thing as well. I'd just be curious. We have that information.
Margaret, you're muted.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam President, Ms. Galan. Well, I mean, we're not sure about the consent agreement. You know, the doctor is not present to address the board, so she hasn't been listening to the conversation, but the board could still offer the consent agreement. And if she refuses it, then it would move to informal interview where the board would have further discussion and the licensee would be requested to appear with or without counsel if they choose.
I just didn't know, since we're talking about suspension, I guess, how pressing we think it is in the sense that if the board, you know, doesn't meet for a couple more months or that kind of thing, or if the concern is something we feel like it's okay to, you know, talk to them and wait. And so I'd like, I guess, to hear the opinion of the doctors on that one.
So, Madam President, members of the board, what Ms. Galan is referring to as a summary suspension, that's usually only used if there is an immediate threat,
right.
Some kind of danger where, you know, the behavior of a doctor is above the normal and reasonable manner for a physician. So I think the board would need to determine if that's the case. Otherwise, I think, Dr. Moffitt, you're just talking about a suspension as part of a disciplinary action, but not due to extreme danger to patients.
I am. I don't see that there's an immediate threat in this case, Ms. Galan, but I do view the suspension as a... So, you know, Dr. Cohen brings up continuing education. In this instance, you know, I considered that also. I've really thought about this all week, trying to determine what I think is the appropriate course of action, just so that I could state clearly what I think should happen for the record. But with regard to continuing education, you know, if we sent her to retina education for 20 hours, she's going to hear about the most recent macular degeneration studies and diabetic retinopathy, lens degeneration, and all of these other things. But in this instance, what I think is really lacking is judgment on her part. And my point is that I want to send a clear and direct message with regard to better judgment. If she needs to pull out a book and consult the proper course of action, then she should do that. In this instance, this was very bad judgment, and I'm not sure that continuing education is going to address that component of it, but I do think that a suspension and loss of income will definitely open her eyes to the consequences of her actions. And so that is why I suggested that. Those were my thoughts.
Thank you. That makes sense.
Further discussion? Mona?
Yes. Hi, this is Mona Baskin. My only comment would be just procedurally, and I would have Margaret jump in on this. What the board could do, you know, you have all of your options before you, but should you wish to offer a consent agreement to this licensee based on the factual allegations, and from what I'm understanding, there are going to be potentially three conclusions of law, you would direct staff to draft a consent agreement with, and I would need to have articulated findings of facts. I mean, certainly you've provided some information, but articulated findings of facts, conclusions of law, which I could go ahead and summarize for you. And then it would have to be brought back to the board for consideration and acceptance. And at that time, you would be able to invite the licensee in at that time and dialogue with the licensee. And then at the next board meeting, whether it be in March or April or whenever the board intended to schedule it, you would have a proposed language for the board to consider and adopt, and you would have your licensee present to dialogue with. So Margaret, do you have any other comments on that? That would be the process. That would be an option.
No, thank you, Ms. Baskin. I think that was an excellent summary. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And
oh, I'm sorry.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Do you have any questions of me?
I was just going to ask, do we need to make a motion then to drop a consent agreement and to pursue mm-hmm. that line of action, just as you described it, Mona?
Yes, that would be a motion. And from what I'm understanding and what I'm hearing, just mm-hmm. to be helpful, if that's the direction the board wishes to go in, there would be three violations, and it would be ARS 32-17-43-812, which is a general violation. It says violating any statutes, laws, or rules regulating the practice of optometry in this state or any other state jurisdiction of the United States. And that would bring us to be able to cite what Dr. Mastoris originally cited, which was ARS 32-1761, which relates to failure to make an appropriate referral in this matter. And I believe not only was it a referral, Dr. Moffitt, you listed several things as far as findings of facts. And then ARS 32-1701-8G, which is the board's definition of unprofessional conduct. Let me get to that. I've got my paper documents here. So I just want to make sure that I'm letting the board know. Yes, and that would be any conduct or practice, including incompetency, that constitutes a danger to the health welfare and safety of patients or the public. So if that would be the board's direction to go in, those would be, from what I heard from the conversation, would be the three conclusions of law that would be contained in that consent agreement. And then the board would need to articulate what they felt were findings of fact. Now, certainly there's findings of facts as far as the chief complaint, what happened as far as procedurally to tell the story, but actually the deviations from the standard of care and what type of referrals would be needed would be very helpful to craft that agreement. And then once we get to that, once we finish that part, then the board would have to discuss what terms they would want in that consent agreement. And then Ms. Whalen would go ahead and work on it. And then it eventually would come to me and then it would be presented to the board. So do we have a lot of new board members and we haven't done this in a while. So just to give an explanation, I hope that's helpful.
I think that was helpful. Very helpful.
Okay.
So
thank you.
My impression right now of the board's position is that we have different ideas of what terms maybe. So this is my understanding, and anybody who disagrees with me, please speak up and speak your mind. But my understanding right now is that generally, I think we agree maybe on seeking a consent agreement from the doctor in this case, but maybe we disagree on the terms that we should offer as part of the consent agreement. So I'll state the terms I thought were appropriate again. I believe a 30-day suspension of the license, and I think probation going forward, so that Dr. Stevens is forced to reevaluate her judgment, assessment, and plan as she proceeds with oversight so that we make sure that this is protected for future patients. Those are what I think are appropriate terms. Dr. Mastores, what terms would you like to see in the consent agreement?
I think I agree with those terms.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Cohen, what terms would you like to see in the consent agreement?
I have a quick question for you. You said probation going forward. Would it be an indeterminate time or would it be the determined?
No, I think that's a great question. I'm sorry. I think that a limited time of probation, it may be like 6 months or maybe 12 months. I guess I'm thinking something along those lines.
If I can add one comment in the course of this is that something that was stated in a number of the notes that were provided, as well as by the patient, just to clarify that an optometrist is a real doctor and is licensed and qualified to be able to provide these services. The doctor is not practicing outside of her scope, outside the scope of licensure. It's a question of judgment and not the capability to be able to deal with a patient like this.
I agree with you. I'll say that for the patient's benefit also. I understand your complete and total lack of confidence in optometrists based on your complaint and the course of events, but Dr. Stevens could have elected to order the testing herself. She could have referred you for fluorescein angiogram to a retina specialist. She could have referred you to ophthalmology, or excuse me, to neuro-ophthalmology. She could have ordered an MRI. There were a lot of different courses of action that could have been taken based on the presentation of your complaint. She just failed to act appropriately. That's my assessment. So Dr. Cohen, I'm not sure, did your terms, were they different from mine? Do you have terms you'd like to see?
Yes, so for clarification, I agree with you with your comment, Dr. Moffitt, if we have a continuing education requirement, is the doctor likely to get it in the areas that's of concern right here? If we do the consent degree, there'd be another meeting in which the final decision about how this would be handled would be discussed at that time. Is that correct?
So yes, right now what we're discussing is our proposal towards Dr. Stevens of what we think needs to happen going forward. She can either consent, sign the consent agreement and go along with it, or she could choose to hire an attorney and she could argue her own position. And the consent agreement could go by the wayside at an informal hearing, and we may have to decide on another course of action. I'm hoping I stated that correctly. Margaret, yes? Ms. Baskin?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that is correct. And she is not required to have an attorney. That would be her option. She could come and appear before the board, discuss the agreement, and enter it into it. It could be modified. You'd have all those options. But it would be just the second step. So, yes, that's correct.
Well, since unfortunately she's not here, to be able to answer any questions now. I'm comfortable going forward with the language the way it's written, knowing that she still has an option then to come before the board and for this to be discussed at a later date.
Certainly. And she was invited to be here. She chose not to. I'll just state that for the record. She chose not to be here. Margaret, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yes. Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. I think it would be helpful to determine, to help you determine the terms if you first solidified your findings of fact. I know there was discussion, but I didn't really get any concrete findings of fact other than the poor judgment. But Dr. Moffitt, I know you had several issues. So if you wanted to maybe talk about those for the language for the order, then I think that would help to generate the terms in a more clear way.
Okay. So I'll do that. I wanted to ask Ms. Galan, did you have any concerns about the terms that we discussed or any?
No, after hearing you explain it when I had my questions before, I feel good about what you're saying, and I am in agreement.
Okay. So with regard then, Margaret, to findings in this instance, she misdiagnosed. So there was an inappropriate diagnosis made. And she didn't.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you a little bit as you go. It needs to be more specific.
Yeah, so she diagnosed a talc retinopathy when in fact there was no talc retinopathy. And we have confirmation from that from the retinologist, Dr. Christopher Reedus's notes. So she misdiagnosed. She failed to refer an urgent vision loss complaint. So in her response to the board, she cited a longstanding vision loss, but in her record with the patient from her office, it says vision loss for a week. So those are two grossly different scenarios when you have longstanding vision loss versus a new onset urgent problem. And that is also corroborated in the retina specialist notes that this was of a short time frame. So by the time the patient saw Dr. Christopher Reedus, it says this vision loss had occurred 1 month prior, and that meets the timeline, that matches the timeline. Okay. She failed to refer, and she failed to order appropriate follow-up testing. And this could have resulted in a loss of, a permanent loss of vision. And ultimately ended up in a loss of life. Neurosyphilis can be life-threatening. This is a failure on a lot of levels.
Anything else, Madam President, or members, for the findings of fact?
I think that summarizes. Go ahead, Ms. Baskin.
Dr. Moffitt, this is Mona Baskin. If you could please, as far as on the finding regarding fail to order follow-up, I know that you said there's a fluorescein MRI that could have been ordered, and then what else, blood tests?
There are a number of, because the way the patient presented with a bilateral new onset vision complaint, this could have been a neuro ophthalmic problem, which it was syphilis. And so there could have been a number of things that were done, but the lab work needed to be ordered, potentially an MRI based on that visual field. If I had a patient in my chair with that visual field, you can't rule out that an MRI is indicated, and a fluorescein. So in a case like this, a lot of times you're faced with, do you want to pursue a potential retina referral? Is this isolated to the retina, or is this a neuro-ophthalmologic complaint? Is this potentially in the brain? Sometimes it can overlap if you have a bilateral complaint like this. So both of those branches could have been followed.
Okay, so that would be failure to make a referral to a retinal ophthalmologist.
Retinal specialist for fluorescein.
Okay, retinal specialist.
Mm-hmm, because they do fluorescein.
Okay, for fluorescein, and what exactly is that? That's a fluorescein angiogram, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And a neuro-ophthalmologist also, right. So those are, okay.
So Right. So sometimes you don't know enough and you have to decide which path you're going to take. Either one of those paths could have resulted in the correct diagnosis. Okay, so are we ready to make a motion? Any other discussion? Okay, so I would like to make a motion that we pursue a consent agreement with Dr. Stevens, which includes a 30-day suspension of license and probation going forward, I'll say for 12 months, regarding misdiagnosis in this case, a failure to refer, and generally practicing in a way that is somewhat incompetent and inconsistent with patient safety.
Okay. And Dr. Moffitt, pardon me. Now, as far as the 12-month probation, would there be specific terms? Because generally when somebody is on probation, there would be specific terms that would be included in there. I know you briefly discussed CE. I don't know if that would be a rehabilitative tool that the board could consider. Would there anything else in addition just to a 12-month that she's on 12-month probation?
Probation, then in the past, I believe they have a practice monitor, right, who would review charts from the practice, so maybe 10 charts a month. And the practice monitor then sends them to the board with a report?
That would be up to the board. There has all the probation that can be crafted based on the findings of facts, based on the concerns of the board to meet any type of rehabilitative goals of that agreement. So whatever the board would consider would be rehabilitative to this licensee. Those would be things that the board could consider. They could do a practice monitor. It could be a chart review. It could be continuing education. I'm just, you know, I mean, the yeah. list is just as long as whatever you consider is going to be appropriate based on these findings.
I believe the practice
effects.
Monitor does chart review, correct? So that's what I envision when I say probation.
Okay.
Does anybody else have any alterations to suggest there?
Yes, Dr. Moffitt, this is Dr. Cohen. I have just a question. The goal of the chart review, since it's not a record-keeping issue, would be the hope that the monitor would be able to look at the notes to be able to see if perhaps it's the appropriate diagnosis or from the diagnosis, the appropriate recommendations?
So yes, this is another OD who's supervising these charts that come in, right? So a similar thing to what we do with the complaint is we look at the chief complaint, the exam that was done, and the assessment and follow-up. So in my opinion, then this is another doctor sort of supervising her judgment, choices that she's making, and then sending a report to the board so that we see if there's a little more careful judgment being displayed. That's what I'm looking for from that.
Thank you, Dr. Moffitt.
Okay. All right, Dr. Moffitt. So it would be a practice monitor that would be assessing, that would be reviewing 10 charts on a monthly basis, that would be assessing the diagnosis, treatment, and follow-up of those patients and submitting reports. Okay.
That's what I think. Dr. Ms. Doris, did you have a comment?
Well, after the discussion that we've been having, I do feel that continuing education would be appropriate. I know that maybe she'll hear a lot about things that aren't, but I, you know, she's a young doctor. And I just don't think it would hurt to have more continuing education as well as a requirement for the probation.
What do you propose then with regard to the,
I think maybe, 10 hours of neuro, neuro and retina. Yeah. Or a primary care.
I'd go neuro and retina. I'd get on board with neuro and retina. Dr. Cohen, any comments on that?
No, I think that would be a good adjunct to the plan.
Okay. Ms. Galan, any comments here?
I don't think the extra education would hurt.
Okay. Margaret, were you going to say something? Yeah.
Thank you, Madam President. The 10 hours, is it in addition to the 32 hours that's owed for renewal or part of it?
I think so. How about you, Dr. Mestores? Yes, Dr. Cohen?
Yeah, I would say in addition, the only thing I want to make sure is that there's access, particularly in these times, to be able to meet that requirement that they can find 10 hours easily, that in retina would be no problem, but neuro-ophthalmology may be a little bit more challenging, but just that all efforts are made to find the 10 hours just because of the times we're living in.
Yeah.
Madam President, members of the board, we have a little bit of standard language when it comes to this. So the continuing education is typically approved by either the board president or the board itself. So if the board is amenable to that, I'll include that language in the order. And they have usually within the first 30 days or 15 days, whatever the board's pleasure is, to find courses to start sending for approval. So it's not
I'd even give 60 days to find the appropriate so that she can really look around for some decent education.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And then is the continuing education due within the 12-month probation, or did you want a separate term for that?
I think 12 months is sufficient.
Okay.
Anybody else? Okay. Okay. All right. So I guess that concludes my motion. That was a long conversation.
Margaret, would you want to read that back for the record?
I was really hoping you weren't going to say that. Dr. Moffitt has moved to issue a consent agreement, or offer a consent agreement, excuse me, to Dr. Kelsey Stevens to include a 30-day suspension from practice, a 12-month probationary period, during which time a practice monitor would review 10 charts on a monthly basis to assess treatment and care of the patients with reporting. Did you want monthly reporting or quarterly?
I think quarterly is fine.
Quarterly. With quarterly reports from the monitor. And an additional 10 hours of continuing education in the area of neuro-ophthalmology and retinal care and treatment of the eye.
Retinology, yep, perfect.
And the continuing education, the doctor would have 60 days to find courses and submit them to the board for approval, or the board president. So I will ask Madam President and the board members. Board members, would you like Madam President to have the capability to just make the approval, or did you want the whole board to approve the CE?
Dr. Mestores, I think Dr. Moffitt would do a great job approving these courses.
I'm sorry, Dr. Cohen, I talked over the top of you.
Yes, I agree with Dr. Mestores.
Thank you. Ms. Galan?
I agree, too.
Thank you. So, Madam President.
Ms. Whalen, does it need to specify these 10 hours are above and beyond the requirements for renewal?
Yes, that will be in there. They'll be in addition to the 32 regular hours that are required. And that was the end of your motion, Madam President.
Is there a second?
I'll second, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Any further discussion?
The only thing I'd like to say is I'm thankful that the patient has recovered sight, and we don't want to minimize the outcome, which is wonderful.
I reiterate your comment as a timely comment, Dr. Cohen. Cohen, I appreciate
it. So thankful for that.
We wish you the best. Okay, so we'll go forward with a vote then here. So I've made a motion to issue a consent agreement, offer consent agreement towards Dr. Kelsey Stevens with the prior mentioned remediation. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
And Dr. Moffitt, and the findings of facts and the conclusions of law, and that the consent agreement will be brought back to the board for acceptance, and the licensee will be invited at that time to attend the board meeting.
Okay. Do I have to say all of that, Ms. Baskin?
Well, you can just summarize it. But yes, technically you should. I shouldn't be making your motion.
Okay. So I've offered a motion, and it's been seconded, to offer a consent agreement to Dr. Kelsey Stevens with the components to suspend a license for 30 days, to have a practice monitor on probation for 12 months, and then to obtain 10 additional hours of CE in the area of neuro-ophthalmology and also retina. This is based on her failure to refer, misdiagnosis, and to act with general incompetence in patient safety. These are our findings of fact, and
the three conclusions of law, Madam President.
Yeah, I don't know what you mean by conclusions of law. I'm not sure exactly what I should
say. The conclusions of law are what supports your findings of fact. So when you look at the violations, the doctor has a right to know what exact statutes or rules are being violated. So those are the ones Ms. Baskin had listed earlier, as well as you and Dr. Mastoris.
Would you relist those statutes for me really quickly, Ms. Baskin?
Sure. 32-1743-A12, 32-1761, and 32-1701-8G.
I'm sorry, what was the last one?
32-1701-8G, as in give.
Okay. So, and then in our conclusions, citing ARS 32-1793-A12, 32-1761, and 32-1701-8G.
Correct. And that the doctor will be invited, the respondent will be invited back to the board to discuss the consent agreement should she sign it.
Okay. And the respondent, Dr. Stevens, will be invited back to the board to discuss the terms of the consent agreement should she choose to. Okay.
Perfect.
Okay. So now we'll vote. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastoris?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. Okay. Our final complaint is Dr. Annie Howe, IR number 202215. And I don't see patient GSF present, correct?
Correct.
Called in. Okay. And Dr. Howe, I don't see also as present. Okay. So if I could get a board summary in this case. Dr. Mastoris, I think you're up.
Okay. Dr. Mastoris here. Complaint number IR202215. The patient is ISF and with the father GSF. He had an exam on January 9th of this year with Dr. Howe. And when the patient presented to the office, they brought paperwork and the staff asked them to provide identification and in the patient's insurance card. There was a discussion out front about whether the patient or was the father was a guardian or they discussed how the patient might be adopted and sounded like the father was did not want to have that discussion. And, you know, adoption process is really difficult to begin with. And so he was upset that he had that conversation and in the reply, I think I can say is that the patient had checked that he was a guardian. And so that initiated the staff to discuss whether he was a guardian or the father. And so that's, I think, what happened. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And so I'd like to open this up for discussion amongst the board members. Any thoughts on this complaint? I'll offer my thoughts here that it appeared as if the miscommunication was based on the patient or patient's father. They were both patients filling out or putting his name under the guardian entry as opposed to the parent. And so this prompted the question and then led to the uncomfortable exchange, I guess, about the adoptive status of the child. I didn't see in there that there was a racial component. Nobody raised it, I guess, with any specificity about why we might jot that conclusion. But they also didn't submit the paperwork to us so that we could see where the patient submitted his name, where he placed his name. But I don't see a HIPAA complaint or HIPAA violation per se. These are my thoughts. Ms. Galan, any thoughts?
Not at this time.
Okay. Dr. Cohen, any thoughts?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Mastores?
I motion to dismiss the complaint as not a failure of the Optometric Practice Act.
Violation.
Violation of the Optometric Practice Act.
Correct.
I would second. Any further discussion? Okay, so we'll open this up for a vote. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Okay. And Dr. Cohen, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. Okay. So move on to agenda item F. Executive Director approval of new license applications pursuant to ARS 32-3123. Looks like we have two new licensees approved in the time period December 3rd to February 2nd. Agenda item G, review, discussion, and possible action on approval of continuing education as provided by ARS 32-1704D and AAC R4-21210. So it looks like this was the continuing education that we approved at the last meeting. The latest in glaucoma management and minimally invasive glaucoma surgery by Dr. Trent Bowen, but they have amended and changed the date to March 1st, 2022. Any comments from the board discussion regarding the change of date concern about approving this continuing education?
Okay. I hear none. Do we need to vote on this?
We do.
Okay, then I make a motion that we accept the amended date as requested.
Okay.
Dr. Mastores, I second.
Okay. Any further discussion? All right. So we have a motion to accept the continuing education as listed. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Okay. Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. Let's see here. So agenda item H, is that correct? Looks like it. Review, discussion, and possible action on approval of testing centers for proctoring of jurisprudence exam pursuant to AAC R4-21-03C. So listed here, we have potential proctoring sites, University of Nevada, Reno, College of Western Idaho, Ada County Campus Testing Center, Yavapai College Testing Center, all campus locations listed in the University of South Florida Testing Centers. Are there any concerns or discussion from the board members regarding these as potential testing centers for the state law exam?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. And just for clarification, Ms. Whalen, you and the staff have done a review of all of these locations.
Yes, Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll need a motion to approve these testing center sites if there's no discussion.
This is Dr. Cohen. I'll make a motion that we accept these testing sites as listed.
Okay. I'll second. Any further discussion? Okay, so we have a motion to approve these listed sites as new testing centers. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 4-0. Okay, agenda item I, review, discussion, and possible approval of board meeting minutes. So the December 3rd, 2021 Zoom meeting did not recall, or excuse me, did not record. And so we had meeting minutes to review. Are there any concerns or corrections to be made to the minutes that we've looked at? I had no corrections, I can say. Any other thoughts, concerns? Okay, appears as if the board has no concerns and no changes to make to the meeting minutes. Okay, agenda item J, executive director's report. Margaret, it looks like you have a lot to talk about today.
Yes, and thank you, Madam President. For those of you who are new to the board, it's just this time of year. This is legislative session, so the director's report is always a little bit longer because I like to report on the legislation that's coming forward, proposed this session. So that's why I did include in my email, don't freak out because the list is long. I just also listed so that you can see what other professions are doing, some of the bills that are being proposed. But let me start with the budget and accounting update. Our fiscal year 22, which we are halfway through, our fiscal year runs July 1st to June 30th. Our appropriation is $241,900. As of December 31st, 2021, our beginning cash balance was $477,753 with an ending cash balance of $466,885. As I stated, 50% of the fiscal year is elapsed with the board spending at 43.91%. So the budget is healthy, our cash balance is fairly healthy, and we're within our limits for the appropriation for this year so far. The e-licensing, item J2, a new platform has been approved. I reported previously at meetings about Salesforce and the issues that we were having. And one of the companies that we were looking at is called Thentia. And a bunch of my colleagues and I had been pioneering that project to make the change. You know, the state was kind of invested in Salesforce. I mean, we were invested. It's our money, but I just meant, you know, work-wise. But finally, on January 14th, 2022, the agencies were notified by the governor's office that Thentia was approved for use by all state agencies who are looking to do e-licensing. So I think that was a great victory for us. I hope we don't have to revisit those words later. The Thentia system is more user-friendly to you, the licensees, and also to the agency staff. And it's very cost-effective compared to the current Salesforce. Optometry is looking to switch over to Thentia as soon as time permits. The system needs to be built, customized, and then launched. But our estimated kickoff date is hopefully July or August of this year. So, you know, you can look forward to that, but I'll report on it again once I have some more concrete dates, because now that the state did approve it, Thentia needs to regroup a little bit to see how they're going to start building for all the agencies. Item number three, staff activity and updates. From December 3rd, 2021 to February 3rd, 2022, 120 renewal applications have been processed. 4 new licenses were issued. 27 phone calls were returned from voicemail, and 2,069 emails were received and answered. I think the email increase is due to the fact that people just don't like to call anymore. We get tons and tons of emails and sometimes even texts because we have a cell phone for the office. So it's just the change that's coming, I guess, as far as communication. Item number 4, executive orders update. Executive Order 2021, dated December 15th of 2021, continues reporting of COVID care and information regarding vaccines administered and the number of cases from hospitals, labs, healthcare facilities, et cetera. That executive order was created after our December 3rd board meeting, so I just wanted to give you a heads up. It's sort of a similar executive order to previous ones that were rescinded. It's just to keep a pulse on the COVID cases in Arizona. Executive Order 2022-01 is so far the first and only order of the new year. It's dated January 19th of 2022, and it is regarding a moratorium on rulemaking to promote job creation and economic development and an internal review of administrative rules. It's quite a lengthy order. The gist is it says the state agency subject to this order shall not conduct any rulemaking, including regular, expedited, emergency, and exempt, whether informal or formal, without the prior written approval of the Office of the Governor. I've been with the agency for 20 years and 23 years with the state of Arizona. There's always been, since I think the early 90s or late 80s, the Governor's Regulatory Review Council. They're still in existence, but that's kind of what their role is, is to make sure that the agencies are not creating, you know, superfluous rules or inaccurate or illegal rules. So this is more about, I think, control of how the agencies are doing rules. So the order does further go on to say that there has to be specific justifications, and there's actually 10 listed, but it's pretty standard. To fulfill an objective related to job creation, to reduce or ameliorate a regulatory burden on the public, to prevent significant threat to the public safety, to comply with federal statutory requirements, to comply with new state statutes, to fulfill an obligation related to fees. And then there's some terms in the order also about the comment period for the rulemaking, and how the requests have to be made. And the one particular part that I disagree with, and it's been kind of kicked around a little bit in Arizona, it's sort of trending across the United States, unfortunately, from other governors, is that, I'm trying to find the exact language here, but it basically says for every rule that an agency creates, it has to eliminate three. So it's about the number of rules and not the quality of the rules, which I professionally disagree with, because I feel like GRC, which is that council I was telling you about, the Governor's Regulatory Review Council, is called GRC. We have a 5-year rules review requirement, and that intention of that report is to keep the agency from having rules that are antiquated or that are no longer effective or that belong to a statute that's been repealed. So we're required every 5 years to report on the rules and to make changes, or at least propose to make changes. And so our current rules, I feel, are fairly tight. Like, they're all doing what they're supposed to. There aren't any rules that don't belong to anything that's in statute. So requiring the agency to get rid of rules just to create one, I think, will be challenging for our agency. So if we end up going that route, I'll have to find a way, or at least ask for an exemption from the requirement to get rid of rules, because that part just doesn't make sense to me. But we'll see what happens. So I'll keep you posted. So that order is in effect. I didn't see a bill specifically for that, because the order does say until the executive order can be put into law. So we'll see if that happens. Okay, on to the 2022 legislative update. We are in the second regular session of the 55th legislature, 2022, which began Monday, January 10th, 2022. Today, Friday, February 4th, is the 26th day of session. So far, 1,410 bills have been introduced, 692 in the House and 718 in the Senate. The Senate deadline to introduce legislation was Monday, January 31st, while the House introduction deadline to introduce bills is February 7th. The last day for committees to hear bills in the Chamber of Origin is Friday, February 18th. So if a bill doesn't get heard in the place where it was created, the bill most likely will just go away until probably next session. So the first bill I'd like to report on is House Bill 2070, Open Meetings Capacity Violation. That actually went to committee the whole in the Senate on February 3rd. It outlines additional requirements for open meetings conducted by public bodies. It amends 38 ARS 38431.01 and 0.02. The new language is all public bodies shall provide a reasonable amount of seating to accommodate the anticipated attendance for those desiring to attend. Any head of a public body that violates the subsection is liable for a civil penalty as prescribed by section 38431.07. There's another section of new language in that same bill that says the agenda shall also include notice of the time that the public will have physical access to the meeting place. A head of a public body that violates the requirement to include notice of the time that the public will have physical access is liable for a civil penalty. The interesting thing about this bill is that they are literally talking about the head, whether it's the board president or the executive director of the board, whoever is giving the notice is personally liable because there is other language that says the court may impose a civil penalty not to exceed $500 for the second offense. It did not have the first offense, so I'm guessing maybe the first offense they just tell you about it. And not to exceed $2,500 for the third and subsequent offense. If the court imposes a civil penalty against an individual member of the public body who knowingly violates this article, the public body may not pay the civil penalty on behalf of or otherwise reimburse the individual against whom the civil penalty was imposed. So let's hope this bill doesn't pass, but it's already gone to COW, so it's probably going to pass. Not that we ever violate that. I don't want to imply that we are. But I just think that's a little bit much, if I can give my opinion for a second there. So again, all these bills are available on a legislative website, which I'll show you how to access in just a minute when I'm done here. But let me go on to the next one. House Bill 2147, State Agencies, Veteran Status. That has had a second read in the House on January 26th. That simply requires the state agencies to ask for veteran status on their applications, which we've already implemented. And we will have a mandatory reporting of July 1st of each year. House Bill 2162, open meeting law violations, penalties. It has had a second read in the House on January 19th. It amends ARS 38431.07. To add the section that says, in addition to or in lieu of the civil penalties prescribed in subsection A of this section, the court may require a member of the public body to attend training on public meetings as directed by the Attorney General, the Attorney General's designee, or the Ombudsman Office of Citizens Aid. So that's why Ms. Baskin and I are always making sure that we are following open meeting law, because we certainly don't want to violate that just in general as a rule, but now we could be imposed civil penalties or training. House Bill 2260, medical marijuana, medical conditions. This bill actually hasn't been heard. It hasn't had any reads, but I just thought it was interesting because it actually adds to the section on debilitating medical conditions to include autism spectrum disorder, including agitation, rage attacks, or self-injurious behavior, post-traumatic stress disorder for veterans, and be a pediatrician if the qualifying patient is under 18 years of age and the qualifying patient's debilitating medical condition is autism. And it also amends the section to add a physician who provides written certification for a qualifying patient who is under 18 years of age. I'll recommend to the qualifying patient's designated caregiver the marijuana's potency and quantity and frequency of use. I was hoping they would have added something for us, you know, just in case for management of certain diseases of the eye for pain, but we weren't included. House Bill 2371, State Agencies Cash Payment Acceptance. This had a second read in the House on January 25th. It amends ARS 35142 to require state agencies to accept cash or money orders for payment for applications, documents, penalties, and things like that. It's interesting because this is something that kind of goes back and forth. It's more of an internal thing. So for a long time, we did accept cash or money orders, and then the treasurer's office came in and said, nobody can take cash because they can't control it or they can't monitor it. They didn't have any procedures in place. And so apparently now they're switching it back to requiring that we do accept cash with our other, you know, credit cards and checks and things like that. House Bill 2412, open meetings, digital recordings, that has had a second read in the House on January 25th. It amends ARS 38431.01 Section D to add each public body shall post on its website the minutes and the digital recording of a meeting not later than 5 working days after the meeting. So it used to be 3, they're changing it to 5. And they also amend the language that says the section must remain on the applicable website for at least 3 years after the date posted. That's currently 1 year. So they're increasing the amount of time that we have to post the minutes and then that they remain posted. Just for the record, our minutes are still posted because I think it's a lot easier for the public to access the minutes at any time. So we have them, I think, dating back to 2009 or something like that, or 2006. House Bill 2599, administrative hearings through GERC, has had a second read in the House on February 1st. This amends sections 12-348 and 41-1009 and 41-1030 of the statutes. It repeals 41-1033. As it relates, so it's basically they're going in and repealing the whole section because of that executive order that they're doing. So we'll have to wait and see. That's actually the only information that was on the bill, so I wasn't really sure what they were doing other than repealing the administrative hearings through GERC. House Bill 2605, duty to report, requirements, and interviews. I thought this was interesting. Well, it had a second read in the House on January 27th, and actually it simply adds the two words forensic interviews. So out of all of the types of duties to report and interviews, it actually just added forensic interviews to that process. House Bill 2612, occupational regulation. That's a very vague and general title. It's had no reads at all, which is surprising for occupational regulation, any type of bill. So it's probably a placeholder for some other bill that they're going to, that the legislators may put through either right at the end of session or instead of using a strike all, they'll just utilize this bill number. Senate Bill 1015, Medical Records for Minors, Parent Access. This has had a second read in the House on January 11th. It removes a parent's right to access and review medical records of a minor child if the parent is prohibited by court order from having any contact. So this will probably affect all of you in practice at some point. If you have an emancipated minor or some court order for that. Senate Bill 1052, medical procedures, prohibitions. I thought this was interesting. It actually amends 36681 medical procedures definitions. It adds two sections. A government entity or any person doing business in the state may not require a patient of the state to submit to a medical procedure, including a vaccination, if a potential complication from or adverse reaction to the medical procedure may cause the person's death. For the purpose of this section, government entity means the state and any political subdivision of the state that receives and uses tax revenues. Personal note, I didn't realize people were being forced to have surgeries or vaccines or anything like that. I know during COVID, some of the employers have been requiring vaccines, which is a hotly debated topic. So I'm not really sure if this specifically addresses that, but we'll see if they had a second read, so we'll see. Senate Bill 1088. This actually only relates to the naturopathic physicians, but I thought it was interesting because it adds to the services a naturopathic or osteopathic physician may inform. So it looks like they're expanding scope a little bit, but it holds a naturopathic physician harmless from liability in specified circumstances and classifies an assault against a naturopathic physician as an aggravated assault. I know there are general laws that protect all of the healthcare workers. You know, from any kind of assault aside from the regular law where it would be a general assault, but it's a little bit different. So I don't know if the naturopathy people were having problems in their office compared to maybe what some other professions are, but I just thought that was interesting. Senate Bill 1111. This is an opioids bill, informed consent for inpatient settings. That has had a second read in the Senate on January 11th. It amends 32-3248.03 related to controlled substances and adds two sections. A healthcare professional who is authorized under this title to prescribe controlled substances and who is prescribing an opioid for short-term use for acute pain as part of treatment in an emergency department or outpatient department of a healthcare institution is not required to obtain informed consent from the patient. And the second section that's being amended is an administrator of a healthcare institution where opioids are ordered for administration to a patient in an inpatient setting is not required to obtain informed consent from the patient to administer opioids. The healthcare institution shall establish policies and procedures that outline when and by whom informed consent must be obtained when opioids are ordered for inpatient administration by the healthcare institution staff. A healthcare professional who is authorized under Title 32 to prescribe controlled substances is not required to conduct an opioid risk assessment before administering opioids to a patient in an inpatient setting. So I thought that was interesting. Opioids are still opioids, so whether they're inpatient or not, and I'm not a medical practitioner, as you know, but it just seems like it shouldn't matter. But Senate Bill 1127, state agencies, payments by cryptocurrency. yes, this is a real bill, and it has had a second read in the Senate on January 12th to accept cryptocurrency. And they have defined cryptocurrency issuer as an issuer from any cryptocurrency, including Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, and Bitcoin Cash. I'm a little scared of that because I'm not as familiar with all the virtual currency. I hear about it, and I know it's been on the commercials and things lately for investing. So, but if the state wants to deal with Bitcoin, I guess that's their prerogative. Senate Bill 1162, opioid prescriptions, intractable pain exceptions. That actually has gone to caucus on February 1st. It exempts patients with perioperative surgical pain, intractable pain, or chronic intractable pain from statutory opioid prescription dosage restrictions. So this bill is gaining momentum. It's actually probably going to have its third read and get ready to be sent over to the House. So, you know, people with ongoing types of pain, as stated, you know, would not be limited to be exempt from the limitations that are currently in place. Senate Bill 1167, Health Information Organizations, Confidentiality Data. That's had a second read in the Senate on January 18th. It's an emergency measure that allows a nonprofit health information organization to receive, use, and redisclose confidential information regarding child immunization and communicable diseases for any purpose permitted by federal law. I'm going to jump down to Senate Bill 1469, Controlled Substances Monitoring and Search Warrants. That's had a second read in the Senate on January 31st. That amends Section 362604 relating to the Controlled Substances Prescription Monitoring Program, of which you all are a part of. It amends a portion of one of the sections. So the entire section reads, the board may release data collected by the program to the following state or federal law enforcement or criminal justice agency. The board shall provide this information only if the requesting agency, and this is the new language, has a valid search warrant and is using the information for open investigation or complaint. So I don't know if there was a problem before, but now apparently you would have to have a search warrant to get the information. Senate Bill 1476, public meetings, in-person attendance. This has had a second read in the Senate on January 31st. It's amending Section 38431.01. public meetings and proceedings. It requires that all meetings of any public body shall accommodate in-person attendance and may not be held completely online or remotely. Two things are interesting about this bill. One is that quite a few years ago, before COVID, the governor was asking all of us why we weren't meeting remotely, especially during the summer, to reduce the the carbon footprint and the emissions and the things like that for the state. And so now that it's required, but the second thing is we've always done both. So today I am working remotely, but Ms. Chavez is in the office. So any members of the public who are attending the meeting would attend in the conference room where she's located. So we've already met that requirement. But I just did find the bill interesting because, like I said prior, the governor kind of wanted us to start looking at going virtual. And everyone was kind of scared to do it until we were forced to do it. So moving down to Senate Bill 1550, occupational licenses, apprenticeships. This has had a second read in the Senate on February 1st. It amends 324821, which is regulating authorities. This is a little bit interesting because it's sort of going to be, if I'm understanding the bill correctly, and only if it applies kind of bill. I think we kind of talked about this before, you know, the only places that have apprenticeships are like the funeral board, the barber, cosmetology, some of the other vocational type boards, you know, dispensing opticians. Our apprenticeship is really school and maybe residency if that, but this one doesn't include residency. So the language basically says under this title, the agency shall establish criteria for granting licenses, certificates, or registrations as appropriate through apprenticeship programs. The criteria shall provide for the following: an applicant must complete a United States Department of Labor approved apprenticeship program in the professional area in which the applicant seeks licensure, either at a school that is licensed by the state or training with a person who's licensed by the state and who holds the same license. The regulating authority requires successful completion of examination for licensure, certification, and registration. The applicant must successfully complete that exam. The passing score may not discriminate between an applicant from an apprenticeship program and an applicant from a vocational or trade school. Regulating authority may adopt rules to implement this section. So again, not sure, we don't have an apprentice program for optometry, so... Senate Bill 1568, Health Professionals, Complaints and Investigations, that has had a second read in the Senate on February 2nd. It amends ARS 3232-23 by adding a section 3232-29. Health Profession Regulatory Boards, notwithstanding any other provision of this title, require complainants to identify themselves in the complaint and make themselves available for an evidentiary review. Complainants may request that their identity remain confidential during the preliminary investigatory process, notwithstanding a complainant's request to remain confidential during the preliminary process if the investigatory process results in a determination that a violation of law may have occurred. The respondent is entitled to the complete investigatory file, including the identity of the complainant, for purposes of providing a comprehensive response to the complaint. Notwithstanding any other provision of this title, the investigation of a complaint by any health profession regulatory board against a permittee, certificate holder, or licensee shall be submitted for board review or administratively dismissed. Which I don't like. There's no administrative dismissal. I don't want that authority. If unsubstantiated within 180 days after the board receives the complaint, regardless of whether the complaint is filed on the board's own motion or by a third party complainant, if the complaint investigation cannot be reasonably completed within 180 days due to the complexity of the matter, the Health Profession Regulatory Board is allowed an additional 180 days to complete its review and proceed with the administrative procedure to submit the complaint for the board review or dismiss the complaint. Two more sections, they're small. Before interviewing any respondent to a complaint, the Health Profession Regulatory Board shall provide the respondent with a notice that the respondent has the right to be represented by counsel and shall be provided with a reasonable period of time of at least 10 business days to retain counsel before answering any questions. For complaints or investigations that pertain to known or suspected physical injury, physical illness, substance use disorder or mental illness that may impair the ability of a licensee or certificate holder to safely practice, and for which the Health Professional Regulatory Board requests or requires a fitness for duty evaluation by a board-approved practitioner, the Health Professional Regulatory Board shall pay the reasonable expenses of the evaluation and report on behalf of the licensee or certificate holder. This is a horrible bill. I've said it already publicly to Mrs. Barksdale, who is the sponsor of the bill. I understand her intent behind it to an extent. I'm not sure she fully understands the intent of it. There was a meeting on Wednesday this week. It ended up being about a 3-hour meeting with Mrs. Bartow and her staff and some of my colleagues to kind of address the issues in this bill. The way the bill is written, we do things a little bit differently. As you know, with our board, we receive the complaint, the doctor gets noticed, they respond, it comes before the board. I mean, this is what we're doing here today. But I think some of the other boards must do it a little bit differently. If they get the complaint and they withhold everything and they call the doctor for information. I just didn't know what precipitated this particular type of bill. And one of the points that I had argued is that there is no statute prohibiting a licensee from hiring an attorney. So why would there ever be any reason to think that they wouldn't know that they could hire an attorney? And so, you know, that kind of became the question of, Senator Bartow did use language like, well, this is sort of the Miranda rights of complainants, you know, complaining. And I thought, well, if I'm a licensee and I get, you know, a complaint, I mean, I think it's my prerogative. I might panic and hire an attorney. That's not, I mean, we've never told any, you know, licensee that they couldn't have an attorney, even at the initial complaint review. And we have had some, so, there's just a lot of detail in the bill that I think needs to be addressed in a different fashion. And it's been helpful to have all the boards come together because some of the bigger boards, we call them the big three, which is nursing, osteopathic, and medical. They definitely do things a little bit differently, and they have a high volume of complaints because they have a high volume of licensees. So if I could boast for just a second, I'm really proud of our process. I think it's very simple and clear and in the correct order. So I think that was some of the issue that Mrs. Bartow was seeing, is that the bigger boards are doing it in some, you know, like I said, kind of backwards fashion, if you will, you know, by trying to get information and then giving notice of the complaint. But every complaint deserves to be heard. That's in our statutes. Like, the public has a right to be heard. So we'll see where that bill goes, but hopefully it'll get amended quite a bit before it moves forward. So, and I mean, the 180 day timeframe, I don't have a problem with, because as you know, we adjudicate our complaints pretty quickly. So I'm not really concerned about that. But does anybody have any questions on any of the legislative items that I reported on? Any clarification? I'm sorry. I know it was a lot of information and it could be horribly boring, but I really just really wanted you guys to kind of get an idea. And if you did have a chance to look at the entire list, I mean, you can see a lot of the boards are doing, like dental has like 10 bills. They're doing lots of various things there. Some of it's just cleanup, some of it's scope expansion. Pharmacy also had several. So, and we're due. I mean, our sunset is next year, as you know. So next year, I'll probably be reporting on some of our bills that we have in there. So that concludes that section. Are there any future agenda items that anybody would like to see on the next few months board meeting?
None from me.
Okay. And future board meeting dates, Madam President, our next board meeting could potentially be March. Where's my note? Sorry, I wrote it down and I can't find my note. March 1st, I think it was. Where's my calendar?
March 4th.
March 4th, excuse me. Thank you. So we'll be looking at March 4th, April 1st, May 6th.
So I'm available on March the 4th. Do we think we're going to need that for sure, given our consent agreement, or we may not need that date? What else do you have?
I will be ready with the consent agreement for that date. I have this, all the complaints that were heard today cleared out my docket, but I did get one complaint in yesterday. Okay. So far I just have one complaint. That's it.
Okay. So do you want to meet in March, Margaret? Or do you want to potentially delay and make it an April meeting?
I'm happy to meet March to get the ball rolling on the consent agreement. Let me ask Ms. Baskin if I could.
Yes.
I'm sorry, because I just can't remember off the top of my head. Is there a time frame requirement for, is it 30 days for this as well or no, just to invite the doctor for the?
No, there isn't. And okay. I am available March 4th. That would be a Friday. So I am free. And then at that time, based on the board's motion, the board would be considering and finalizing that consent agreement with the doctor present. So I wouldn't see any timelines on that. Yeah.
Ms. Galani, how's your schedule for that day?
Works for me.
Dr. Cohen, you're good?
Yes, I am.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, Dr. Mastoris. So, Madam President, if you wanted to do March 4th, depending on what happens in between, you know, then and now, I mean, we can always, because we are only mandated to meet six times a year, so we generally meet every other month as a rule of thumb, mm-hmm. But we can certainly meet whenever we want, you know, within those parameters. So we could forego the April meeting if we have a successful March meeting. We don't have enough board business for the following month. So
okay,
totally up to you. So so we're all aware. So March 4th, I'll send out a reminder. Mm-hmm. March 4th, everyone's available. Thank you. And that concludes my executive director's report, Madam President.
Okay. So then call to the public. Any members of the public that would like to address the board? Okay. I hear none.
Hey, Ms. Chavez.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry. I was asking Ms. Chavez if anyone was with her in the conference room there.
Gotcha.
I'm guessing not.
No, there is not. I'm sorry, Margaret. Okay. Sorry, Ms. Whalen.
Thank you.
There's not. Uh-huh.
Okay. And then agenda item L, board member training presentation. So Ms. Baskin, I think you have some board training for us.
Yes, I do. But out of respect for everybody, everybody probably needs a 5-minute break. So I would be requesting that at this time.
Okay.
If we could just take a short little recess. Thank you.
Okay. So I guess we'll meet back 11:06.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
I hope Ms. Galan is returning because we don't have a quorum without her.
Waiting for Ms. Galan still.
Dr. Moffitt, I just transferred over to the to call in so that I can have an emergency patient to see, so I can listen and still be participating in the meeting by phone. Am I on now? Is there a way to check? It said I'm in, but it didn't.
I can hear you, Dr. Cohen. This is Mona Baskin.
Yeah,
Margaret.
I don't see him in the on the calls. Let me.
I see him on the screen.
Yeah, I haven't left yet. I'm just trying to.
Okay.
I do not see you on the phone here yet, Dr. Cohen.
Okay, so shall try calling back again.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you have to enter the meeting ID and the passcode. It should prompt you for that.
And okay, got it. I'll do that right now.
Dr. Cohen, if you have an emergency, and I would leave that up to Board Chair and Ms. Whalen.
Madam President, members of the board, it does not look like Ms. Galan is returning unless she is very late. So we wouldn't have a quorum without her at this point, since Dr. Carpenter is not present. So we would need to adjourn the meeting.
Margaret, could you call her or email her or text her?
Certainly. Let me do that.
You know.
Maybe with just the one complaint. And for next month, we'll have more time.
True. Okay, I messaged her, Madam Chair, so hopefully she'll come back on.
Okay. Well, I'll just say, I'll reiterate what Dr. Mestor says, but if we have to push this to the next meeting, at least we pick up Dr. Carpenter and maybe Ms. Galan. And so, I mean, the goal is all the new members and myself get board training. So maybe that's the most desirable path. We'll see if she comes back.
Right. And then if she does not, then we would all have to go into open session, and then Margaret would, well, are we in open session, Margaret?
Right,
we would announce
session.
That. Would, okay, good. All right. Well, then if she does not join us, then the meeting is adjourned for lack of quorum.
Okay.
So yeah, that's how it would be handled. And then the time noted.
Yeah, maybe she misunderstood when we said we were taking a 5-minute break. Dr. Cohen, I'll tell you that your Zoom, your picture of your house is still up. So I don't know if you want to exit out of that before you go.
I'll still wait to see what we're doing.
Okay.
So I tried calling and said the meeting ID was not valid.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. I don't know why that's happening, but.
Yeah. So I'll just wait to see what happens now so that.
Okay. Well, it seems to me if Dr. Cohen needs to leave and we've lost, we have two other board members that we've lost, that maybe we do this at the next meeting instead. Okay.
I support that, Madam President.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then.
Apologies to Mr. Baskin. I'm sure he put a lot of work into it. I'm sorry we're not finishing up with it.
Oh, please, please. Dr. Cohen, we can wait till next month, but thank you kindly.
All right. Can I have a motion to adjourn?
We cannot. We can't.
Oh, no.
There's no quorum, so you will just make a statement that says, due to lack of a quorum, the meeting is adjourned.
Okay. Right. All right. Mm-hmm. Due to lack of quorum, then the meeting is adjourned.
At
11:13.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. We'll see
you
next month.
Thank you.
Okay.
Your faces.
All right.
All right.
Okay. Goodbye. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.